hi.
Under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're supposed to take our clothes off at this point.
Disclose.
Yeah, I'd be completely...
That close, disclose.
Transparent.
Yes.
That means...
Transparency, just like...
Transparent.
Just like Twitter... is trying to be more transparent. I don't know how you can... If you have a transparent Twitter, you would see right through your phone.
Could be. Or you definitely see through your text messages.
Yes.
Well, the Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, where a couple of guys who happen to be the same ones that are going to be talking on the radio today, that's presuming that...
Us.
Yeah. So today is October 14th, where you are and where we are at the same time. They're basically the same thing, except one is an investment advisory firm and the other one is a radio program. And those, they are affiliated, and the stuff we tell people in our office or over the phone or through letters and so on, that's investment advice. But the stuff, that's a technical term we use, that we are going to tell you in this next 2 hours of radio program is not investment advice. It's intended to be educational and commentary and our general thoughts on things, but it is definitely not investment advice, because investment advice has to be rendered individually, because you're different than other people, whoever you are, presuming anyone is listening. And everything
I'm not listening.
And all the stuff we talk about. See, there's that technical term again.
Stop using technical terms. It's just really difficult to follow what you're saying when you keep using words like stuff.
Right. All the information that we provide on this program comes from sources that we believe to be reliable and accurate. However, we make no warranty or guarantee that it is. Anything else I need to say? Close cover before striking?
No, I think we've said all we need to say for the next 2 hours.
There's very little cover, closing, and striking goes on anymore, if you think about
it. People use a lot of lighters.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, that's matchbooks and so on. And if you, anyway. But if you'd like to give us a call and ask about or comment about anything to do with the economy or investing or things of that ilk, you're certainly welcome to do so in the telephone number in here at KTEM. Again, assuming that today is October 14th, where you are is where we are, and that yesterday was Friday the 13th, where you are, is 254-773-1400.
All right.
Or you can actually send us an email at either Jeff or Jake. See, Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Because we do actually monitor our email while we're in here. People generally don't email us while we're in here, so we get junk email and
We monitor the junk.
We monitor the junk, yeah.
Well-monitored junk email.
And the light is flashing, which indicates that somebody is calling us at 773-1400. So you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show.
You do.
Excuse me, there was an article in the Wall Street last week that said three of the seven Board of Governors on the Fed, I guess, are vacant.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on to say that in the event of a financial crisis, they wouldn't have enough sitting members to deal with it. So I guess if there's a big, you know, global crisis of some magnitude, what's going to happen if they don't have enough people to deal with it? So I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you very much for that call.
Actually, they got a majority. They got a quorum.
They've got a quorum. And
as long as one of them doesn't leave.
Yeah. The deal is, and this is something we talked about this at the end of the Obama administration, it can continue as long as there's log jams in Congress. It was the Republicans keeping the Democrats from nominating, and now it's the other way around. It's not just the Federal Reserve Board. The Board of Governors is made up of a bunch of bank heads, the area banks of the Federal Reserve. And then they've got some appointed members of the board. And the appointed ones are the ones that are, for large part, in charge. The head of the Fed, in this case, Janet Yellen, her assistant head, which I'm using the wrong title on purpose just because I think Harry Potter has a better way of looking at this stuff.
Vice chairman. He's
yes.
In charge of vice.
But the chairman is a woman. So I'm going to call her a head. So then she will literally be a talking head every time she talks. So the vice head, I like that better than even assistant head. That's
vice head,
the
yeah.
Vice head, the chairman, and there are, as you said, five appointed by the president and approved by the Senate, or advised and consented by the Senate. They don't actually approve; they just consent. Well, there's not been a whole lot of consent. So all the way up to last week, we had two that were. One of them was leaving, and we knew of the three. There was one that was leaving. We knew that was going to happen. We were going to go down to two. Well, we've got one approved. One's coming in. And that's the vice head, which is a great 5-year-old insult, by the way. If you want to teach your insults, it's better than silly head or many of the others. Just call them vice heads. The vice head has just been appointed, and he'll be coming in under Yellen. Now, what does that mean? What is it? What's important about what the Fed does in a crisis? They've got a quorum. They've got the three members. And the article last week is they need to approve the guy. Well, they approved the guy last week. In order to make decisions like what the interbank lending rate is or whether or not to buy or sell bonds on the open market, they've got to have a quorum. And the intent of the Federal Reserve Act was to make sure that the largest power is held by non-political, bipartisan appointment through the executive branch and the legislative branch rather than heads of banks. Because if the banks get in control, then you're talking about exactly what Thomas Jefferson was afraid of, exactly what all the laissez-faire folks are afraid of, is that the banks are making the decisions in the bank's best interest instead of in the best interest of the country.
Yeah, and basically, what President Trump is doing, in effect, is shifting the power on the Federal Reserve Board to the regional bank presidents that are elected by the banks.
Or what someone is doing. It's not necessarily Trump, because
The buck stops there.
Well, the buck stops there, except that he had someone nominated for quite some time, and it's taken this long to get him through.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't nominated anybody else, though.
Like, three openings now?
Yeah,
Nominated three people.
He should have nominated three people. By not nominating, he is giving the banks a lot more power, and the academics that are supposed to be looking out for, well, that's what hurt us last time, not what's the bottom line profitably. He's giving more power to the banks. In effect,
I don't think it's intentional, though.
No, I don't either. I there are so many people that haven't been nominated. I don't think that when we're talking about Federal Reserve, the SEC, there are.
Well,
the SEC board is extremely limited too. It's supposed to have 7 members. I think it's got 2.
The State Department is running with the most unnominated, unfilled positions that it has run since World War II. I mean, basically, I say since World War II. At one time, it didn't have a lot of the undersecretaries of state for various things, but then again, we weren't a world power at the time. But since we have been a world power, this is the largest number of open positions we've had.
Yeah, and that's important because the effort that the president is making is by circumventing, using the power of the executive branch to shrink government. But it's without regard to the priorities of which pieces of government need to be in control still. I mean, if you're talking about the Federal Reserve, we really do have a situation that was not intended by the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act was supposed to have a strong group of people whose only motivation was for the well-being of the country, and a smaller group of people whose motivation was we've got to be profitable in the process.
Well, the net result of the absence, and not just on the Federal Reserve, but across the federal government right now, the net result of the lack of nominations, and I understand the reason for the lack of nominations. Basically, President Trump wants people who will be extremely loyal to him, and that's it, end of issue. And finding people who would pass through the Senate who, based on purely their loyalty to President Trump, is probably growing more difficult by the day. But what effectively happens is, for instance, all those undersecretaries of state and undersecretaries of the Treasury and undersecretaries of various things that are traditionally appointed by the president, nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, are extremely high quality people who come in for a few years and then leave when the administration leaves. Those positions are filled. They're just filled by career civil servant bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
They're the acting undersecretary for whatever. The problem is they don't have very much authority. So if the acting undersecretary of state for Middle Eastern affairs, there is one,
mm-hmm.
shows up in Jordan or Saudi Arabia or something and says, here's what we'd like to do, that has very little weight in negotiation because he's just he or she.
He's got no political clout.
The acting, it doesn't have the favor of the president.
Or any political party.
Could be replaced at any moment if the president suddenly decided to nominate somebody to the position. So
this is just for the record here, last month, close to the midpoint of September, Donald Trump nominated out of the blue. He's just not been nominating for a while. He nominated 42 different positions, big positions. Somebody, I don't know if this was General Kelly or what, saying, hey, these are essential roles.
I suspect it was General Kelly.
We need them. So he nominated 42 key positions. That includes justice, agriculture, defense, executive agencies like the Office of Personnel Management. And while that may not seem like a big deal, it's a huge deal because they were running out of people to figure out what they were supposed to do to pay people money that worked for the government. It's really kind of important. The General Services Administration, the bureaucrats of the bureaucrats that you really need in order to have anything function.
And this is an interesting point. None of these people have met Donald Trump.
No, they didn't have any interviews.
Their names just appeared.
Yeah, he just suddenly, there was like a shotgun. All these people are nominated. And at this point, they are likely to be approved almost en masse. I mean, the Senate may do it all at once. And for that purpose, it was completely, in my mind, it was completely unintentional. But the result is going to be probably the fastest approval process Pardon me, the fastest consent process of a nomination group this large in the history of the United States.
Except perhaps in the State Department, because in order to get considered by the Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee has to approve a nominee at the State Department. And in case you haven't noticed, the president and the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have been in a verbal war.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's
he also nominated a bunch of ambassadors. So he nominated the ambassador to post in Djibouti, when most people don't even know that Djibouti is a country.
Well,
I've got to say, strategically speaking, Djibouti is one of the most important countries in Africa.
Yes.
It's sitting right across the water from
its
Yemen.
Only stock and trade.
Yeah, it's a tiny little place that has lots and lots and lots of special forces bases, not just for us.
And it's the only Chinese, the People's Republic of China, it's their only foreign military installation is being built right now, mostly underground.
The Russians have special forces bases there. The Chinese have special forces bases there. The French, the Germans do not. The Germans basically, if they had a special forces base, it would be one folding chair at this point. Their defense budget is so tiny. But we have quite a few, and it's because if we look across the water from Djibouti, and just as a side note,
ideal place. Those
of you that are interested in this, you probably would already know about it, but look up Djibouti. It starts with a DJ. So think Django Unchained, it's Djibouti. And
the Djibouti.
And yeah, there's a lot of jokes you can make with the name, but we haven't had an ambassador to Djibouti, and it's an extremely strategic location.
And that's, by the way, that is their gross domestic product is almost exclusively from renting land on which that foreign forces and who hate each other can build military bases.
And without us having an ambassador there, we had the short straw in all the places we didn't want the short straw, and the long straw in all the ones that we wanted the long straw. So it wasn't just Djibouti. It was Angola, Zambia. Zambia is important because he mispronounced it in his speech to the Africans at the United Nations. He called it Zambia.
Zambia?
Yeah. And so the fact that he's got this going on there, it isn't as strategically important as the other places that he nominated. But
you don't want to criticize him for not understanding African nations, or he'll threaten to pull your broadcast license.
Right. So Croatia, important. Estonia, important. These are right there, right up against Russia, who is expanding wherever they get the chance. Then we've got, a little place like Switzerland. We didn't have an ambassador to Switzerland.
Why do we need an ambassador to Switzerland? Why do we need more cuckoo clocks?
The Seychelles and Niger. So all of those, the Seychelles, by the way, are pretty strategically important because they're way out there. So we get all this stuff together. This happened, it looked like, because General Kelly, this is just pure supposition, but it sure makes sense according to the evidence that we're looking at. General Kelly said, we've got to get these positions filled. What does this have to do with the economy? A lot. Ambassadors to foreign countries, particularly countries in Angola, Zambia, Djibouti, those are Chinese expansion areas. Niger, it's a very chaotic area that's pretty close to a lot of oil. So not having ambassadors there is dangerous to us long term. But if you'll think about the names of the countries that I've just read off, most people don't even realize those are countries. The fact that it's a priority for the United States to have ambassadors there is important to understand strategically. It's amazing to me that we've taken this long to do it. Anyway, the concept of getting the Federal Reserve Board, the nominees in place, get them nominated first, then get them in place, the more that we have on the board that have an academic background that are not wrapped up in whether or not they're making a profit, but rather whether that profit is something that's sustainable and healthy. It's vital in this, in the event of a recession or any kind of financial emergency, and that can include all kinds of things, to have a well-stocked, well-vetted, intelligent board of the Federal Reserve that can look at what they're supposed to look at and make decisions based on that information without having to have a political back and forth between the for-profits and that, well, yeah, but that's really going to hurt us long term. That's what we have Congress for, by the way. They're the ones that are supposed to be short-sighted. The House of Representatives, we have short-sighted. The Senate's supposed to be a little bit longer-sighted. And the Federal Reserve is supposed to be looking way out into the distance while kind of making sure we're on course to get there. So anyway, that was a long-winded answer to a relatively short question.
Yeah. Well, bottom line to it, the Federal Reserve has, I think, no specific number of people. I was looking for a quorum number on the Federal Reserve, and I think if the board
they just need to have a majority of the votes, I believe.
Mm-hmm. But the political appointees that the president nominates and the Senate confirms, there really don't have to be any there. I think the chairperson needs to be there, but the voting banks on the board could just do it all without anybody that has been approved by the Senate.
Well, what it says on the Federal Reserve site is that a majority of its members shall constitute a quorum, which means that if they only have
one member.
member, that's a quorum. So they never have too few, just whether or not they can do the work that's required. One of the fantastic things about the Federal Reserve is each board member brings their own staff, and their staff are also generally, if they're appointed folks, then they are generally academics. So they're able to gather data very quickly from diverse places. You don't want to get all of your information from the banks. You need to get information from other places too. And not that the banks are going to be fudging it, but they are looking, in some cases they are fudging it. Wells Fargo going through fudging scandal after fudging scandal. You do want to be looking at other sources of information. And that's why having more members on the Federal Reserve is better. Because the reality of the situation is that when to raise and lower interest rates isn't that difficult of an equation in economics. The Wall Street Journal does a poll of about 27 economists every month on what they think the Federal Reserve is going to do into the future. And they've been doing this since somewhere around 2004. And they have been right. The consensus of these 27 economists has been absolutely right as far as what the Federal Reserve was going to be doing, going back, you know, give or take a 0.1% differential, which means that the Federal Reserve Board is making decisions based on the known parts of economics, the part that actually is science rather than just conjecture or political motivation. And that's the realm of the Federal Reserve. So we need to get them filled up. It's not our purview to do that. That's the president's job and the Senate's job.
Well, actually, there's some other things happened this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.43%. The S&P 500 was up 0.15%. I think the Dow may have closed out with a record. The S&P 500 didn't. I think it tends to hit its records on Thursday for some reason, and then coast on Friday. I think people take leave early or something. But the interesting numbers, at least to me, looking at the S&P 500, year to date, it's a little over 14%. 1 year from a year ago, right now, the S&P 500 stock index is up about 20%, 19.7 something. And a lot of people, at least a lot of writers who publish in financial journals and so on, are saying, oh, my, 20%, oh, we're headed for a crash. Oh, bad news. We'll talk about crashes a little later. This week will mark the 30-year anniversary of a very significant event in the stock market. But the point is, if you look at earnings, you look at the price-to-earnings ratio of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index. And the price-to-earnings ratio, by the way, is the price divided by the earnings. And it's the same as it was the trailing earnings. It's the same as it was a year ago, almost exactly, which means the stock market is not going up because of wild speculation. The stock market has gone up over the last year because of increased profitability of American companies. Here is one of the keys to that, though, that kind of roll around in your head if you're interested in such things. Most of that earnings growth has been outside the United States. What it really boils down to is Europe has come back like gangbusters. The emerging markets have come back. China has done very well. And to the degree that the S&P 500 companies are invested and have sales and activities overseas, their earnings have risen accordingly. And two or three, there's a lot of other things that go into that. But from strictly a stock market perspective, the market is not running out of control. It's not entering into a period of irrational exuberance. It's not exuberant at all. There's an abundance of articles by market watchers and participants that says the world is coming to an end. And last week we had, I don't have the exact numbers here, but the last several weeks we've had record inflows into bond funds.
Yeah.
I'm a little curious about that. I suppose there's an awful lot of people who have no clue what the future is likely to hold, because it's a very simple issue. Interest rates are higher this year than they were last year. Yes, they have come down during the year because they jumped upward right after the election. Interest rates jumped upward right after the election because there was this assumption by those who loan money and those who just an assumption that there would be a great boom in the economy with all the wonderful things that President Trump was going to do when he was elected. And that big boom in the economy would cause loan demand to skyrocket, which would cause interest rates to go up. So people took actions, which amounts to selling bonds, that raised interest rates. Since then, the interest rates have been coasting downhill. They've been coasting downhill because there is a serious question whether any of those things are going to come to pass. The economy, the growth in the economy and the growth, the meager growth in loan demand, has remained constant now for about 2 years. In other words, the last year of the Obama administration, 2016, and the first year of the Trump administration, as we look at the actual, what's going on in the actual economy of the United States, if you left all the political stuff out, if you just wipe that, you would say there's been no change. It's just the companies are becoming more efficient. They are doing better overseas. Now, there's an exception to that, not to go on too long here.
Multiple exceptions.
We can talk, but there's a big exception to that. And we wrote about it in the newsletter this week, which you can get by either calling or emailing us, Jeff or Jake at tvwc.com, and we'll send you a copy. China is importing 9 times as much oil from the United States this year than they did last year.
They're well on track, just a few years from now, to flipping our deficit of trade with them if they just keep importing more and more gas and oil from us. And that's kind of a good – that's one of the many good things about the fracking industry is we're able to provide
– We're exporting 2 million barrels a day of oil. Did you get that? 2 million, roughly 2 million, which is about the same as – Kuwait does, and Kuwait's one of the biggest oil exporters in the,
yeah,
in the world.
We're right around the number three position.
And
if we just keep doing what we're doing, we're still expanding our production capabilities. We may be up there with Saudi Arabia and Russia very, very soon. By the way, those are the other two.
And I would expect us to be there because we're still, having just come back from wandering across East Texas or West Texas and other places, there are oil rigs out there still poking holes in the ground. And we are continuing to produce oil, and we produce the oil that's produced out of these shale fracking fields, I love that, is sweet, meaning that it has low sulfur, low heavy stuff.
And Just go ahead
and,
with this.
And produces a lot of the lighter, more volatile fluids like gasoline and kerosene and diesel and stuff like that.
I wanted to clarify something you just said. You just said we're exporting more than Kuwait.
No, about the same.
Let me clarify that. We're exporting as much as Kuwait produces.
Oh, right. Well, they export
they export the vast majority of what they produce, but this is our excess. I mean, we're still importing, and this is where people get – you were just saying this. People don't understand this very well. We import a lot of oil. We're producing a lot more oil than we're importing, and we're exporting less oil than we're importing. How's that for confusing?
Well, it is very confusing.
We're still exporting oil, and the profit comes here.
And this was a shocker as I researched this. Our biggest source of oil imports by far is not some desert kingdom where people are running around with a bunch of clothes wearing really long dresses.
In fact, it is the land of moose and polar bear.
Right.
It is Canada.
Our biggest source of oil outside the United States, our biggest import source is Canada. And guess who our biggest customer is for exports?
Canada.
So this I'm talking about oil now.
Yeah.
Okay?
So we get oil from Canada and we export oil from to Canada. So we import and export. When people talk about GDP or they talk about the deficit of trade or the trade imbalance and all that stuff, we have to keep reminding them when it comes to oil, we are still, when it comes to import export, we're a net importer. But the reason why we're still exporting is that the vast majority of the refining of oil, the capability to refine oil into whatever product you want, whether it be plastics, gasoline, kerosene, Vaseline, any of the other enes, propylene,
propane,
it comes here. The vast majority of it here comes to the United States, specifically into the Gulf of Mexico area. And it gets produced here, and then it goes back to the country that still owns it in many cases. So think about this. No real trade happens here, except that a tanker will come into the port offshore, unload into a pipe, goes to a refinery, picks up some refined material, and turns back and goes back to the country of origin. They never sold us the oil. They're buying the service of refining it, but it's considered an import. This is why we're still net importers, because some of it, they just say, okay, sell it to the Americans. It's already there. So when we talk about Venezuela, when it comes here.
Not Venezuela.
I didn't.
Venezuela.
I don't believe I said Venezuela.
I'm just trying to picky about something.
Okay. We shall be pedantic because that's
right.
What we do.
That's what we do.
The oil, when it comes in from any country, but there are a lot of countries very close to us, it gets refined here and it stays here. And they sell it to us piecemeal, basically, at different gas stations. So that's a real import. It's really hard to track that because those aren't part of the numbers that were put together by Woodrow Wilson.
Not Woodrow Wilson. Herbert Hoover.
Herbert Hoover. Yeah, Wilson refined it.
The issue is imports and exports in a global economy, in many ways, are meaningless. Now, not completely meaningless, but they're getting there very quickly. As a matter of fact, the value – I was just read an article in the – I think it was in the journal. It might have been in The Economist. That the total value of data transfers, which, by the way, generally does not get reported in the GDP numbers, between the United States and the rest of the world, is approaching the total value of all our physical imports and exports. So basically, when we look at the imports and the exports as part of the GDP and we subtract the supposedly losses that we have because we import more than we export in dollar values, we're missing a very, very, very large piece of the economy. And if you threw that back in there, it would result in us having a positive balance of trade, very likely. Now, that's not certain, because this is the point. If you download, or if you look at an article or a website, as I do, and it happens to originate in Great Britain, that's value. You have gained value by looking at a website in Great Britain. In other words, you've brought value, you've imported value into the United States, but it doesn't get recorded as an import. But if you look at who is looking at data and paying for it by looking at the advertisement or buying the advertisement or all the things that are going on, the amazing thing is that the majority of that is exports from the United States, as the Russians proved when they sent us a bunch of money so that they could buy political ads.
Yes.
But they pretended to be U.S. organizations while they were doing that. Therefore, it distorted the balance of trade data.
All right.
That was an import, by the way.
I'm going to throw in some more things, because these numbers are important to understand, and they're not well defined by people. And why are they important to understand?
They're not even well defined by economists.
Right. They're important to understand because they become a football. They become a political football. And if you don't know what the football's made out of, when someone throws it to you and you expect a nice leather or pigskin.
Actually, it's synthetic.
Synthetic. And it turns out to be made out of the metal lead. You may drop the ball.
You may get killed by the ball.
You may get killed by the ball. So when it becomes a political football, we should understand some things. You were just saying, we're the number two producer, by the way, right now.
Of
oil in the world.
Oh, okay.
As far as countries go. This is where the difficulty in that number comes from. We may be the number two producer of oil as a country, but American companies are the number one producers of oil. So we produce about 10, almost 11 million barrels a day. That's what we're pumping in the United States. Mm-hmm. ExxonMobil produces 5.3 million. Are they producing half of the fracking and all the other oil going on in the United States?
Not even close.
No, because they're getting that oil from all over the world. And if you look at who's doing the pumping in Kuwait, you'll see that it's American and British and other companies that are multinational, but mostly American.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask, you know, concerning money, you know, what you say it's safer putting it in your mattress or burying it in your backyard or keeping it in the bank, because I was listening to the news, you know, that little sawed-off Korean guy up there, you know, they say if he was to throw one of them nuclear warheads close to this area, you know, that it would put some kind of a grid into the atmosphere and everything would be locked down. It just was a question, you know, is your money safe in the bank?
Yes.
You can't get to it if that happens, or should you just keep it where you can get to it if you need it? You have a good day.
All right. Well, I can tell you the answer to that one is it's safe in the bank.
And the grid that you're talking about is an electromagnetic pulse. When a nuclear explosion takes place, a nuclear reaction that's large enough at all, it throws the electrons that are hanging around in the atmosphere into overdrive, and they create a big magnet, in effect, a wave magnet that goes out from the center, and it can fry a lot of electronics. Mm-hmm. Most electronics get fried. That can happen from sunspots. It can happen from a lot of things. So the reality of the situation, though, is if – let's just go there. Let's go all the way out there and say all the banks lose all the data. All of the people don't know how much money they have.
Don't know how that would happen. But
I don't either. Because
I can't even imagine how it would happen.
The backups for this stuff are magnetically sealed. So they're in the when people talk about the cloud, the backups of different parts of the cloud, if they're well-run clouds, have shielding from electromagnetic pulses, from any magnetic pulse. I mean, it'd be really silly. There are some people that set up shop next to a hospital. If there's an MRI in there, it's got a magnet big enough to fry the electronics. They shield the room that the MRI is in so that the person sitting next to that room looking at their computer isn't constantly every day replacing their computer. So we have shields there for electromagnetic pulse. Part of the stress tests that the Federal Reserve do for banks is making sure that the backed up data is there in case of physical disruption to their ability to gather the data currently.
In answer to your question about money in general, like I get a lot of questions, well, not a lot, but I get a number of questions. People say, well, isn't the money – United States currency is not backed by anything. It should be backed by gold or something. Well, no, it is backed by something. It's backed by the taxing authority and the GDP of the United States.
It's backed by us, yes, all of us that right. are listening to this right
and,
now.
And the Chinese, for example, who are among the biggest buyers of gold in the world, do not use gold to back their currency. Either they use dollars to back their currency. As a matter of fact, the dollar is the backing for most of the currencies in the world, either directly or indirectly. And the dollar is a good that we export. The quality control is done by the Federal Reserve Board. And it works exceptionally well. And we have banks that are required, as Jake said, to have backup data and backup positions that are shielded. And that's where your money is, in these electronic signals, carefully shielded, carefully backed up, and better yet, insured by the largest entity, basically guaranteed by the largest economic entity on the planet, the one that the Chinese, if people think, well, the Chinese, they really got their act together. They don't, but the Chinese think that the United States dollar is the most appropriate backing for their currency, and their economy is totally dependent upon the dollar backing their currency, or it would collapse.
There's another piece here. Let me throw this in, because the specific example was electromagnetic pulse. That right. wasn't the word used, a nuclear
grid.
Rocket Man shoots a missile.
Sawed-off guy.
Shoots a missile, and it blows up, does something to the grid. Well, the grid is the electric grid, not a grid in the sky.
You just don't want to live in California.
Right. It's possible they could reach further. Okay, so the grid is shut down. No electricity.
Mm-hmm.
You know those new credit cards and debit cards that have been going out in mass, the ones with the little chips on them?
Right.
Those aren't affected by magnets. So that's one thing. Two, the grid being shut down, NASA has been talking about this for a long time, not from a nuclear threat, but from the sun. In the middle of the 1860s, we had some massive sunspots that shut down the telegraph service for about 3 weeks, where if you even touched the telegraph machine, you would get shocked because the radiation from the sun was causing electric radiation to happen. It was causing any long copper wires to produce a lot more electricity than they were supposed to. So NASA's been talking about, we need to shield our transformers, we got to protect our grid. Good news is that the grid, and there are four major grids in the United States.
I thought there are only three.
Well, there's one that's not. It's just becoming major. There's the Western Seaboard, Eastern Seaboard, Texas, and there's a little one that's beginning in the Midwest.
Oh.
Texas is way, way ahead of the other power grids in being prepared for some kind of a magnetic or
event. Yes.
We still have a lot of work to do, but that's what we should be doing. If you put your money in your mattress to avoid the events that have never happened in history, you're putting yourself at risk to a much more common risk of house fire.
Or theft.
Or theft.
But speaking of money, KTM stays on the air because it sells advertising, and in addition, it runs other stuff. But it needs to play commercials to stay on the air, and I think we have some commercials to play.
We do, and we'll be back on the other end. If you'd like to join the Personal Wealth Coach, I'm Jake. This over here is...
You join the Personal Wealth... Oh, we get a call.
Well, we'll wait for the commercials till right. after the caller.
Okay, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was a caller just before y'all started talking. I was just going to say, man, you know, you two guys are just like an encyclopedia full of knowledge, and Einstein ain't got nothing on either one of you.
Oh, but he does. He's dead.
Yeah, we are not as dead as he is.
No, we're not. And he's actually a lot smarter than we are.
Yeah, if he were alive.
If he were alive. But yeah, his brain's still around. It's dead. Okay, well, we got a break for the commercials. We'll be back on the other side, and thank you for the compliment.
Yes. And we'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we have about 5 minutes left in this first hour today, October 14th. And somebody tried to call just before we jumped into commercials or PSAs or whatever they are.
I think this is important to say right about this point, because we get a lot of what if scenarios, and we're extremely conservative. Old Baldy across from me is wearing both suspenders and a belt.
He always does.
That's just a normal thing. We're conservative when it comes to finances. We want to make sure if our money's in the bank, that we don't have it above the FDIC insurance amount, that we know what that means, that we know we're not trying to find on a CD the highest interest rate out there. People go, well, why not? Highest interest rate is the best. Well, not too long ago, the highest interest rates on CDs in the nation were in Puerto Rico, because the banks were in trouble. FDIC is there. It will help, but it's a headache and a bunch of red tape that I don't want to have to mess with. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to try to go out and find the absolute most possible return. We want to find good stability. When we're talking about safety, not necessarily in the investment world, but safety of the banks, we want to say, all right, what are things that have happened in the past and what would happen if they happened today? Well, that's amazingly got a name. The Federal Reserve calls that a stress test. And they've got some really, really crazy stuff that they're testing for. And by the way, I would highly encourage you, if you're listening to this program, you're at least part nerd. We are fully nerd and partnered nerds together. You are my partnered. This is my partner in crime, my partnered in crime. just by saying that pun, I proved my nerdliness. The concept here is, look at the institutions that are supposed to protect your wealth. Determine if they're better at it than you are. And in most cases, they are, because there's more of them than there is of you. And if you're talking about depositing your money in your mattress, just make sure you never tell anybody about it. And when you start having to spend money on chiropractors because your mattress is so uncomfortable, you might want to consider using a bank. There are things that you give up by using a bank. If they're closed, it's hard to walk into a bank, but there are ATMs, there is online trading for paying bills and for making withdrawals and so on. So one area of importance, this is something that's happening across the ATM networks, is they're shielding them. They're beginning the magnetic shielding. So keep that in mind when we're talking about. Do some research.
The other thing is, as a person who is trained in EMP and what it did and how big of an area it's going to hit.
You're trained in EMP?
Yes, electromagnetic pulse.
You're trained in it?
I was, yes.
Wow, can you do one?
I could at one time, but I don't have the equipment anymore. Mm. It belongs to the government, and I think it belongs to stay with the government.
Yeah, and they don't like it when you test it out.
Let's just say that, what's his name,
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un, a.k.a. the sawed-off little guy.
Rocket Man. Sawed-off little man.
Sawed-off little rocket man.
There you go. Yeah.
Were to launch an ICBM, and it managed to make it over some part of the United States. He has indicated California is his target of preference.
and he were to detonate a nuclear weapon and the electromagnetic pulse would hit the ground, and there would be a circle, an area where most digital electronics would be toast. Cars would stop running. Lots of interesting things would happen. But that area would only constitute, with one nuclear-tipped missile that he might be capable of doing or might not, that area would only constitute an area at most a couple hundred miles across.
That's at most, and that's if he got it exactly optimally right.
And he wouldn't, because the issue is they're not sure. He's not at all sure that it would survive reentry, so he'd have to set it off pretty high. It would cause a little disruption in some other areas and would result in his demise.
Very, very quick demise.
So, yeah, it's always possible that he might be able to pop one over Hawaii or maybe California. I don't actually think that the accuracy goes down with distance.
Yeah.
So if he's actually going to hit a populated area, first off, he hasn't done any long-range tests on his missiles to make sure they can hit the right spot, so he's not sure it would hit anywhere.
Before you downplay it too much, we still are talking about a catastrophe that makes any hurricane that we've ever faced look minuscule.
Well, I don't know. It's no worse than what happened in Puerto Rico.
Oh, it is, because a lot more people would die.
Well, no, nobody would die necessarily.
For an EMP. The nuclear bomb is the threat, not the EMP.
If he were able to pop a nuclear bomb, right now he's never had a successful reentry, and that is a big challenge, meaning that, yeah, maybe he can put a nuclear weapon, and he showed a picture of one that if that indeed was a nuclear weapon, it would go on a missile, and he's capable of lofting the missile up there. The problem is getting it back into the atmosphere, through the atmosphere at high speed, and not having it just vaporize. And that is a major, major, major challenge that he has never indicated, suggested, or demonstrated that he could do. So the reason he mentioned the thing about the electromagnetic pulse is because you don't have to make it down through the atmosphere to set off an EMP bomb. And yes, he could knock out some electronics and power supplies, and it would nowhere be near as bad as what Puerto Rico is suffering right now. The difference is it would be a tremendous boost to us.
Central Texas home for news radio, KTEM AM, 1400, Temple, Belton, Killeen.